Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audience. I hope you're having the kind of weather we are having here in upstate New York. So here I am. I'm back. Wonderful audience. Spring is here. All kinds of good signs. When I sit here at my desk, I'm looking at this huge glass window I had put in that looks out over a wooded hill and out over the tiniest creek and the tiniest pond you imagine. But I have a pond and a creek, and we get great blue herons in it, and we get wood ducks, maybe one of the most beautiful birds in the world, rarely stopping by, even kingfishers. And it's a 6-inch deep little pond with a little waterfall. Life is good, and I want to talk a little bit about engaging life as I go over, of course it's spring, as I go over some of the things I always want to share with you. This is Open Mic Wednesday on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. 888-874-4888. And that's what you call, and you will, we have a space for a few people at a time to stack up like human airplanes waiting to land on the show. And I'd like you to start calling in, you know, as soon as you can, because you can ask about anything, you can talk about anything you want, and I'll try to be helpful. And maybe other people will call in and try to be helpful. So, 888-874-4888. And for those of you who just happen to tune in and don't even know where this show is, it's prn.fm. And we have an app. PRN has an app, so you can listen to this anywhere you want. And if you want to stay in touch with me, remember the frequent alerts. There's a great big button on my website, breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, great big button. You press that, you get frequent alerts, and they'll be emailed to you for free if you sign up. And it'll keep you in touch with lots of things going on. I do anywhere between 1 and 3 a week on average, I'd say. But right now, I'd like to see some folks calling in at 888-874-4888. I keep getting on my special dedicated email for just for this show. I keep getting requests on my live call-in, which is BregginLive@Hotmail.com, BregginLive@Hotmail.com. Asking for referrals, and I really don't have a list of referrals other than you'll find on empathictherapy.org, our second website, and on there you'll find people who don't pay anything to advertise. They just give us their names in a paragraph and we put them up. We can't vet them, but these are folks who say that they support our viewpoint. So that's the best place to go for that. And daily breaking news on Breggin.com is thriving. It is what I hoped it would be. It has become. My wonderful assistant, Ian, who lives across the country and works with me on a daily basis, really, in just about everything I do. Ian is really the leading figure here in this breaking news, and I find it interesting because a lot of times I'll see some breaking news that I hadn't really thought about or seen, One of them is interesting. It's a study in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology. And they do confirm with their interviews, their surveys, that there is an increasing number of people who are describing themselves, young adults who are describing themselves as emotionally distressed. Not mature adults over 25, but young adults. And the percentages who describe themselves in the last months has really been jumping in comparison to 10 years ago and in comparison to even a couple of years ago. So we know this from a lot of different directions. And there's so many things going wrong in young adulthood that in America today that it's, you know, hard to know what to look at, you know, whether it's street drugs and psychiatric drugs and self-diagnosing people. Ourselves and our friends diagnosing us, the isolation that so many people are getting into through social media, the fact that so many young people are really pushing themselves, the adolescents in particular. This was a survey of adolescents through age 25, and the backpacks. The backpacks they carry, you know, they're like soldiers in boot camp, some of them. So we need to be thinking more and more about it. And I think that this whole idea of adolescence and teenage years now and kind of making them a whole new segment of society when in the past, you know, before the 1950s, you grew up and then you became an adult and you did something useful. And now it's very different. So many people are getting higher education. So many people are not getting the jobs they want, even with the most robust economy we've ever had in terms of full employment in all the brackets, all the demographics, race and women and so on. It's employment's way up. But still, awful lot of kids don't become adults, they continue to live with their parents. So something going on there that we need to just keep thinking about, and I think I might write about it in the next year. And then interesting new study on the evolution of mindfulness, and you might just want to look at that. It has a bit of a history about the development of mindfulness. And this is, again, on our wonderful section on Fresh Breaking News, which I'm going to be emphasizing more and more on the website because it's a wonderful, good draw. And you may not know that the literature now and the practices now are moving more and more toward focusing, not on love and not on a hummed word or whatever else we've been doing over the years, but now on sort of existentialness, not on loving kindness, but sort of wisdom. I'm not sure where that fits in with emptiness, non-attachment. I thought non-attachment was a hallmark of Buddhism going back a long, long, long way from what I've read. But again, give a call if you want to talk about that. Be interested to hear what you think about various kinds of meditation. And whatever's on your mind. And we're starting to get now the callers, and I'm so glad you're starting. You're popping up, and I'll be taking callers in a couple of minutes now. I wanted to address that it is spring and that the key to life is love, and the key to love is engagement. Love is a joyful engagement, a joyful experience, a taking happiness in the world around us, people around us, animals around us. You know, I live with my wife and my mother-in-law. My assistant is here much of the day. We have people coming and going. This is not where my office is. And I got birds and animals out the window. And it's hard for me to come downstairs in the morning and you know, be grumpy like I was today, not feeling up to par, being grumpy and looking out the window. And here it is, March 27th, 2019, and I see my first pair of mallard ducks in my little tiny pond. Hunkered down. They stayed for the whole morning. I hope this year, this is our second spring here, and last year they just kept coming and going. They never settled and never had kids here, but I hope they will. I'd like some grandchildren ducks, ducklings. It's just hard to stay depressed when you let yourself respond or grumpy or tired or irritable as I woke up this morning. I think I overdid my exercise yesterday after my did an hour with my trainer. I did a bit too much of aerobics, and I think I woke up pretty achy from it. So, but again, there's just so much to do in life, so much to do. And I just wish for all of you, you know, this spring and this summer, just fill your life with things you love to do. And even though I do a lot of things I don't love, sometimes I do it because it brings a good income and it's a good thing to do, like legal work, or sometimes I'll do legal work for the love of it because I think it's an important and good thing to do. Psychotherapy, I just always love seeing my clients, even when it's stressful. So let's just get on with some questions. Let me hear from Joel in California.
Hi, Dr. Breggin.
Hello, Joel. How are you today on this beautiful day in upstate New York?
I'm doing good. I'm out here in California, and we got some nice rain, and we have some birds out, too, so it's a nice day out here.
You sound very good, and your voice sounds very good. Nice quality to your voice. Are you on a cell phone or a hard line?
I'm on an old-fashioned hard line.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you're next door. You were calling about children.
Yeah, I was wondering, I'm with you, I share your skepticism and you know, troubledness over the medication of people with psychotropic medication in general, but particularly with children and young children. And one of the things I'm wondering is just coming from this stance, it's easy to, you know, confirm my own biases and see what's wrong. Is there any place in your experience and your understanding, is there any place where it actually is shown to be helpful for a child to be on these medications?
Well, do you have an idea that you want to present me with? I have come out and said that I think responsible professionals should begin to actually examine whether or not we should ever, ever, ever give a psychoactive substance to control the emotions or behavior of a child. So do you have an idea, Joel, that you want to present with me?
Well, it's more I've been asked to help a local school kind of wrestle with this with professionals that are trying to push this, and from my standpoint, I'm a psychotherapist, and I see childhood as a time when you're with the people that are going to love and care about you more than anyone else. And it's the time, it's part of our job as parents to help our kids sort of master their emotions and their experience and their unique worlds. And for me, the idea of putting an antidepressant or a stimulant or something in there to make that easier or to kind of mute it in some way is, you know, it's setting up kids for disaster later on when they're grown and they haven't had the chance to master these things. So I guess, I mean...
You want some support on not give, not making exceptions, it sounds like. By the way, I have... my wife keeps reminding me to mention books. I have two books that specifically and solely address this. You know, one of them is the Ritland Fact Book, and the other one is the Talking Back to Ritland. The Ritland Fact Book is a little simpler, and Talking Back to Ritland is a little bigger and heavier. I think that if parents were told that every time you put a neurotoxin into your child's brain, you're putting the whole brain at grave risk, you're putting much of the body at grave risk, and the addictive stimulant drugs we tend to give are going to make them more prone to addiction later in life, and it's going to stunt their growth. And the antidepressants make most children worse. I mean, the real studies, the scientific studies that have been done, not the FDA studies, which are basically marketing studies, you know, they're created by the drug companies to get their drug through and market it. I think the marketing department spends as much time or more on these little studies than the so-called scientists do. None of them are scientists. They're practical engineering types. They're not real scientists. It's not an investigation of a scientific nature. It's a drug promotion that they set up to get it approved. That they just make kids get very disturbed, upset, anxious, the antidepressants, aggressive, suicidal, psychotic, manic, and so on. And in principle, once you give a drug to a child, you're saying you're incorrigible. Now, it used to be no incorrigible kids was the motto of one famous movie. No incorrigible kids. Well, now we're saying, oh, yeah, tons of them are incorrigible. That is, they need to be drugged. Well, it's just nonsense. You know, when you change families and you change schools for the better, kids do better. It's as simple as that. You help families change. You help schools change and address the needs of children, and the kids get better. And it also disenfranchises the teachers. It teaches them. There are a lot of kids they can't teach. My mother-in-law, Jean, taught school for, you know, more than 20 years in third grade, and she never had a kid that she couldn't basically bring up to age level. She never had a kid she couldn't manage in the classroom because she believed in her own authority, and she believed that kids could be addressed in a rational, meaningful, and caring way. And now teachers have got all these kids they can't handle, have to drug them. It disenfranchises parents, teachers, coaches, everybody, ministers, priests, rabbis, because they think there's children they can't address. When what every kid needs more than anything in the world, every kid more than anything in the world needs is an adult who loves them, protects them, and helps to educate them. And many children are saved by literally one adult in their lives. And it may not be a parent. It may be a teacher or a coach or somebody, you know, in church. So I think that we're just doing a horrible, horrible disservice to our children when they medicate them. And you've got those two books, you know, to back it up.
Thank you. Yeah.
Joel, thank you for calling. Any closing thoughts?
No, I just I appreciate your work. I read your book, Toxic Psychiatry, a couple of decades ago, and it affected me in a very good way. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you. And people, Toxic Psychiatry is still, you know, one of my best books. It's really one of the best books there is in this whole field. I think it has helped start everything that's going on now, because what you who listen to me on the air know is that practically every stranger who comes on and who has got a critical view read Toxic Psychiatry. Many of them more recently, the book's still in print, still available. I'm just going to go in order of the callers, and I'll go to Cary in North Carolina.
Hi, Dr. Bregan. What a pleasure to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you for calling.
Absolutely. I'm just thrilled to be able to do it. I'm a therapist as well, and so usually Thursday afternoons I'm with clients and I'm listening to you after the fact. So it's just so nice that I actually set this time aside so that I could call you. And first of all, thank you for being honestly such a support listening to you, because I think I find that I'm surrounded by folks in the mental health care system as well as my patients. My own awareness about the dangers of the medications actually really solidified for me about 4 or 5 years ago. And I've been working hard to try to raise awareness both with other medical professionals around me and other therapists. And, you know, I find myself being ridiculed and demeaned for this mindset. And I guess I just have thought so many times, because certainly you have been in this position for seemingly your entire career. And so I just sometimes feel so discouraged. And so I thought it might be nice to call you and just first of all say thank you. And secondly, just ask you, how did you persevere? I mean, how did you continue to move forward, you know, swimming against the tide? Because, you know, it's what I have found out. I mean, there have been several clients, not many, who have been willing to try some of these alternative approaches, like meditation, like dietary changes. I mean, those have been huge. And the clients that are willing to put forth that effort and to try it, I mean, I've seen tremendous improvements in how they're feeling. And I know that this is the right way. And, I mean, I look at the studies and I also see so many folks on these Facebook groups who are just suffering as a consequence of the medications and what has happened to them. And honestly, like even before I started looking at these studies, I mean, I guess I'm just sort of, it blows my mind how many people are in this field and who don't, I mean, the evidence is right in front of your face. I remember when I first got out of grad school and got into private practice, it seemed to me that the clients that I had that had the most significant issues of depression or anxiety, and I would ask them about their medication histories, and they would give me some of them sheets of paper with like 20 different medications listed that they had been tried alternatively, you know, for, say, a couple of decades. And my light bulb was going off, and I thought, if these things were working, why aren't these people feeling better? And so it just, first, I'm just so surprised that more people in this field, that it's not just something that they're sort of naturally aware of. But, you know, once I started really looking at the research, and once I started really, you know, working with people through dietary changes, and certainly, you know, there's so much research now on the microbiome and how effective working with that is. And so I just, but the reaction I'm getting, like I put together a notebook of studies for a lot of the general practitioners that were referring patients to me. And this was a couple years ago, and I was very concerned once I really became aware of how dangerous the medications were. And so I put together a notebook of peer-reviewed scientific data to try to raise their awareness and at the same time tell them that, look, they're, you know, we're having great success by doing some of these alternative methods. And Dr. Bregan, you know, none of those doctors have referred a single patient to me since. And so I really wanted to ask you, how did you continue to stay in this field and to, you know, to have such a voice of dissent when everybody else around you is still sort of brainwashed?
Well, let me try to answer that in a minute or two, but I'd like to learn a little bit more about what you're dealing with. Now, if you don't mind, are you having trouble getting patients? Because I don't think you should have trouble.
Well, to be honest with you, so yes. I mean, there was a time that on my website, I was a little bit more forthcoming about my approach. And honestly, I was not, you know, and people would come in to see me, and I would not sort of launch into that conversation immediately. I would, you know, I would sort of be very gentle around it, but what I've noticed with a lot of people who are on the medication, when you, even after you have cultivated a relationship with them and you start trying to talk to them about, you know, what some of the long-term outcome studies demonstrate about these medications, they become quite upset. And so, yes, in fact, I'll tell you this. So I took about a year and a half off. And this is what really changed my whole mindset. My dad had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I took a year and a half off. He had decided not to do chemo and radiation. And you know, there's all these studies on what they call alternative ways of curing cancer. And he had had a really bad stroke, and so they had decided that they were not going to go that route. And so I said, you know what, why don't we try this? And we tried it, and it worked. His oncologist had told him that if he didn't do 6 months of, I mean, if he didn't do chemo and radiation, he would be dead in 6 months. And a year and a half later, when he went back to see his oncologist, his doctor did not have one question for him about what we had done. But it totally shifted my understanding about wellness. And I really began to research
what,
a lot.
What did you do, Carrie? What was your approach?
Well, in large part, I looked at the study done by T. Colin Campbell.
That's the China study and his yes. son, Thomas Campbell. Yeah.
Yes. And so I looked at that. And so I also understood that cancer cannot survive.
Hang on a minute. Folks, what that is what you've been hearing about on the show from me and from Pam Popper. And both of us know Campbell and his son and the China study, which began the real movement scientifically toward a plant-based low meat, not necessarily vegetarian, but really a plant-based low meat. I think for a cancer, you'd want to get rid of all meat and chicken and fish. But the plant-based, no dairy diet, whole foods, and you know, not a lot of junk foods and stuff. And if you look up Pam Popper, go to my archives, look up Pam Popper, and you'll hear what we have to say about all this. You can also go to Pam Popper's website. The cancer actually shrank to nothing or to a little bit or what?
Cancer, and apparently had, you know, it had advanced by the time that it was discovered. And so, you know, I've always just been infinitely fascinated. And, you know,
But Carrie, I lost you. What happened to the cancer and your dad?
Oh, so he survived the cancer. Now, if you look at PSA as a measurement of prostate cancer in a man, and there's obviously some controversy around that, when he went back to the oncologist, he was told that his PSA level was that of a healthy man half his age, and so yeah, he was fine. And so, from all intents and purposes, the cancer was gone, and we did not have to do that much. I mean, we put him on a plant-based diet. It was all organic. We got him off all the toxins. It was basically, for the most part, a raw diet. And then I only used a couple of different supplements. Wake Forest University Medical Center did a study, believe it or not, on the muscadine grape seed and found that it inhibits the growth of 7 different types of human cancer. And you'll never hear about it. I mean, it's even hard to find the study online anymore. But now someone, there's been an anonymous donor, and they have invested $20 million so that Wake Forest University will actually do this study in vivo. The two cancers that the muscadine grape seed impacted the most were prostate and breast cancer. So I used a muscadine grape seed supplement and a turmeric supplement, and we just got them off all the processed food, got them off all the sugar, and got them off the casein, you know, the casein protein, which is the animal protein. And it changed the way I ate too. I mean, if someone would have said to me,
you know, Carrie, you are such a good communicator, and you have a nice spirit to yourself. It shows through in your voice. I think that you need to think about how to promote yourself locally. It won't happen through the prevailing system. One of the keys to my success is I never was in the prevailing system other than when I consciously decided to go into it to get my medical degree and my residency training. I knew when I was 18 years old that I wanted to reform psychiatry. I didn't know it was going to get as bad as it did. It got worse and worse and worse. Psychiatry is not a science, so it can get worse and worse and worse at any given time. It's not science-based.
When you know the history of psychiatry, it's hard to imagine.
But in your case, Carrie, you need to find a way to get out in your community and talk to people, hold free seminars, give free classes, let people know who you are.
It's not so much. I'll be honest. I'm busy enough at work. It's not necessarily my concern. I think my biggest concern is sort of the prevailing sort of medical community around me.
You're not going to be able to do much about that, and your esteem. I mean, my esteem does not come from what the prevailing medical community believes, or I don't know what would happen to me.
You know,
it depends on other people. It depends on you. It depends on my wonderful audience. It depends on professionals around the world and psychiatrists who call in and talk to me. Call me and get. I've had two psychiatrists this week get in touch with me. Want to talk about how can they live better lives. So
I think you're really hitting on something, because I think what it is that I am sort of an outlier here. And so I do not have a sense of connection around me professionally where I feel supported. And so I think you're right. And I think that's probably what really motivated me to want to reach out and talk to you.
Yeah.
To just sort
of there's
validate.
A lot going on. My website tells you a lot about what's going on in the world and my frequent alerts, but Madden America has such a varied website.
There.
Its purpose is to introduce people to each other in large numbers and on all ranges of opinion. So that's a great asset for you. And maybe you could just put a little note in a online or in a newspaper on your website that you want to set up, a group of folks who are in the therapy business and get together. It's an outreach issue. You have to create your own professional association in a sense and go to meetings, because there are meetings all over of people, who feel like-minded. You would love to come to our meeting that I jointly sponsor with Pam. She really runs it. But she allows me to say I co-sponsor it. And that meeting's in early November. You can find out more about it, not on my website yet. I'm a little lame about getting that up there. But you can certainly go to Pam's website, and it's going to be, I think, November. I'm just looking at my appointment book, 4th and 5th, something like that.
That's a great idea.
November 8th through 10th. I'll get that up on my website as soon as I can.
I love that idea. I really want you to know how much it has meant to me. I mean, your courage, I just can't even speak enough to how much strength and courage I can imagine that this has required of you. And
determination. I think it's a purpose I got, and it's just my determination. Well, call back again, Carrie. Keep up with us. Let us know what's happening. Folks, I've got about 20 minutes, I think, left. So, and I've got enough callers, so everybody else just sit back and relax. And let me go to, what Emily is asking, what do you do after you stop medication? I think that's a kind of a really good topic for everybody, because it's about life. Emily, How are you doing? Have you gotten hooked up here? Did Alex get you hooked up to me?
I think so. Can you hear me?
I can, Emily. Okay, what do you do after you stop medication? I gather you stop medication, or you're talking about some other people?
No, I'm not a doctor. I'm a patient, I guess you'd say. So,
A person. You're not a doctor. You're a person. Go ahead.
I'm a patient.
A person. Yes.
I am in the process of getting off of Abilify. I've been on it for quite a while, and I've kind of just put my foot down after hearing from you and realizing that it was not good for me. So I'm down to 5, which is the lowest I've ever been, and I'm doing well. I'm just in that process, and I've read your book, the majority of it. I didn't read it from front to back, but the psychiatric drug withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to gather as much as I could from it, but afterwards, and maybe this was answered in your last caller, but afterwards, what's the best thing to be doing? I know you're against natural remedies during detox, but it sounded like there wasn't science that showed that helped, because you're just
there's three things that make a healthy life. One is the psyche or the soul, the spirit. The second is a vegetable-based, doesn't have to be entirely vegetarian, but a really vegetable-based diet. The caller mentioned the books of Campbell, both the father and the son, that they've written a number of good books. And there's a wonderful movie, old movie, Forks Over Knives. Once you get into this arena, you'll just see a lot of stuff. And you can go and call, you know, Pam Popper's office even. I haven't done this on the air, but I think this is a good thing to do. Pam has people who will talk to you about what is available there. I have a two-part course. The first part is about how to help yourself, and the second part's about helping other people. If you call Pam's office and talk to them, don't sign up right away. I think the price is too high, and I'm negotiating with Pam, who is just a wonderful woman. I want to see that price come down, but you can call 614-841-7700. So 614-841-7700, and tell him anybody mm-hmm. that you've been talking to Peter Breggin and what kind of courses has he got, and tell him that you want to see a much lower price than $400 or $500 that's what I get for turning my phone on for this course but get interested in it, talk to him about signing up, but let's see what the price is going to be, I think, in the next few days. And mm-hmm. that's another way to go. I've written a book called The Heart of Being Helpful, which is about good living, and Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety is another of my books. But life is about love. Life is about engagement. Life is about finding out what keeps you from daring to take yourself seriously and the rest of your life seriously. It's about saying, I don't want to feel overwhelmed anymore. I don't want to obey horrible feelings. I want to live by reason and love. I want to learn to take charge. And it's that work. And a part of that work is letting go of where you've been in the negative ways, embracing the good ways, and just getting engaged in life. And mm-hmm. I think mild exercise, incredibly useful and helpful. Eating well is helpful. Finding a good therapist is helpful. Various spiritual activities can be very helpful to people, prayer to God and to yoga, to all kinds of things, acupuncture. People have gotten a great deal from alternative treatments. But the idea has to be to embrace life and embrace the new things and the good things and really get to believe in yourself. And it makes that huge difference. And maybe find a decent therapist if you can. Talk to friends. Call people on the phone. Not a psychiatrist. My colleagues there, they're bent out of shape around the drugs. They're all twisted around pills. It's a terrible thing that's happened. Emily, I wish I could spend a lot of time just talking about this with you, but call again, will you? And thanks for calling in, and I want to try to get to a couple more people who've been hanging on.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me go to caller 3 in Virginia. It says RAG. I'm not sure what that is. Hi, are you there?
Thank you, Dr. Bregan. This is Raj Edwards. It's R-A-J.
J, okay. They got it wrong. I think that's the first error that my terrific guys have ever made. R-A-J. And you were talking about laws in the United States. And Raj, I'm not sure what you're talking about. What can we do to change the code of laws in the states?
Well, every state has these laws, not just the age for smoking or drinking or voting, and they are usurping that relationship between parent and child. At the same time, they're subjecting our children to all sorts of brainwashing. Even in third and fourth grade, they're imposing on them gender confusion, of all things. They're going ahead, and first thing they're telling them is imposing vaccines on them. And they're now castigating parents who are not allowing their children to be vaccinated, though it has been very clearly established that vaccines are creating aluminum toxicity far beyond what the toxicity levels are for adults in children. Even children, babies who are 6 months of age.
Yeah, there's no question that our kids have simply become a marketplace. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at sick videos or sick movies or provocative clothing, giving them drugs and 57 vaccines, I think the number is, for the early childhood period. They've just become a marketplace, and we do have to stand up on a very broad level. It's not all about laws. I mean, the involuntary treatment laws, I think, are a travesty. They don't help people. They imprison people into taking drugs or staying in hospitals until they take their drugs, and then they can be forced afterward. And the laws that prohibit Americans from raising their children the way they believe in, I think are by and large very bad. So I'm with you 100. Well, I don't know if it's 100%, but I'm very much with you.
May I suggest you're addressing this one specific problem where parents and the school boards and their elections, we've got to make sure that healthcare freedom is imposed. I mean, the NIH has requirements even for all the human experimentation they do, yet they're subjecting our children by school psychiatrists, all the teaching they get in psychology 101 in colleges, without teaching them.
Healthcare freedom is a favorite phrase of mine. I'm thinking a lot about it, and I'm extra inspired by you, but I've been thinking a lot about how to approach healthcare freedom. I want you to know that. I think it's a huge, huge issue. I don't think that people should be kept from using anything unless you can prove it's a public health menace and a grave danger. I think people should be allowed to experiment with what treatments they want. and to take the treatments they want. I don't think anybody should, any treatment should be outlawed because doctors don't like it. I think the only way to outlaw something is if you can prove it's a toxin, in which case you would be outlawing all the psych drugs first. So I think this is a very serious area to begin looking at. Thank you, Raj. Stay tuned. There'll be more about healthcare freedom on this show as time goes on. Let me go to Alan, and I'm not sure I can get to some of the newer callers like Todd and Julie, so let me just let you know that you may have to call in on our next Friday or do you know, almost any day with those questions, you could call in on the show. But if you want to hang on, go ahead. Alan in Maryland, drugs that can change neurons in the body. What did you want to contribute?
When I was a young man, I just starting in neurology and psychiatry, I had the opportunity to do some research with a very very bright and very honest woman who she was a pediatric neurologist. And what we did was, I was working in a state hospital at the time, and I was just going into practice, and I had a chance to do research on serotonin metabolism. And what we did was we studied the effect of various psychiatric drugs on serotonin metabolism, and we found that all these different drugs did different things to the body. And we published the results in the Archives of General Psychiatry, and the title of it was Depressed 5-Hydroxyindole Levels Associated with Hyperactive and Aggressive Behavior. And this was published in, it was 1976, March of 76, Volume 33, and what I realized at that time was that these different drugs, they're different things to the metabolism. In some cases, they raised serotonin levels, and in most cases, they lowered serotonin levels. And in fact, when someone got put on a antidepressant, it actually decreased over a 30-day period. It decreased the level of their serotonin rather significantly.
And Alan, as you probably learned, that's because the brain's fighting down. It's shutting down the production of serotonin. It's increasing its ability to get the serotonin out of there, because it doesn't like this flooding of serotonin of the synapse. And so you're going to get these very unpredictable increases, decreases in various places in the brain, redistributions. It's not good for you, clearly not good for us.
Right. Well, it seems to interfere with the calming effects of serotonin, so that, as you well know, you've been in court many times, over people who have had their serotonin lowered to such an extent that they become increasingly hyperactive and aggressive and angry and homicidal and suicidal. It's quite outrageous, actually.
It is. But Alan, I'm not totally in agreement with you that these people had lowered serotonin. We really don't, we can't measure what's going on in the human brain because it would destroy the person. And I just like to say, and I think it's true, that you're getting totally unpredictable, maybe even random at times, massive changes throughout the brain, and not just in serotonin from the antidepressants. Dopamine immediately begins to react in its own way, acetylcholine begins to react in its own way. So you get a hodgepodge of unpredictable mess going on.
Well, you do, but some people actually, there would be some people who would have their serotonin raised and other people.
That's right, and you wouldn't know where. And what are we talking about? We're talking about serotonin spreads throughout the entire brain. It's in the gut. It's in the, you know, it's in the spinal cord. It's
I don't want to be too
scientifically exact, other than to say it just messes things up.
Right. See, I was afraid to use these drugs in my practice because I never knew what kind of side effect I was going to get.
Are you still in practice, Alan?
And it was very frustrating.
Alan, did you become a psychiatrist? Everybody wants to know, I'm sure. Or a neurologist?
I was a neurologist and a psychiatrist, and I did this kind of work for a long time. And I actually eventually had my license taken away because I got interested in detoxification of the brain. And the reason that they didn't want me to detoxify people, I had to learn how to do this myself. I had to learn how to do this because it seems like 4 out of 5 people actually had very large amounts of toxic elements, especially heavy metals, in their body. So
it's not an area I know a heck of a lot about. Alan, if you would like to get in touch with me, you know, I'd love to have you email me, and of course, any of my listeners.
I would love to get in touch with
you. Yeah, it's BreganLive@Hotmail.com. BreganLive@Hotmail.com. I save it, I only announce it on the air, and so everybody who calls pretty much knows. But get in touch with me. I want to pick up on another caller now, and I'd love to hear from you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Golly, we have only 2 or 3 minutes. I haven't gotten the warning that the music's going to start any moment. It's been a very interesting show. Julie in Massachusetts, can you say a word about mental illness labeling and...
Yeah, I was. Hi, Dr. Brennan. I'm formerly of Massachusetts. That's what I wanted them to say. But anyway, I have noticed something. They used to call it something I cannot pronounce, anastagnosia or something like that.
Yeah, anosognosia.
You are not aware of your something that's wrong with you. But now they're calling it something new. I've just seen this in the media, and I've just found an article on the so-called Rational Wiki, a huge article on mental illness denial, and that's what they call it now, mental illness deniers.
Oh, that's right. They tried to take a very good neurological term.
Yeah, what they did was, they're aligning us with climate change deniers, Holocaust deniers, and anybody who, you know, flat earthers. In other words, they decided they didn't want to call us a complicated disease anymore. Now they want to call us just plain wrong. And, you know, deniers of what their truth is. It's very interesting the stance they're taking because they have changed it. You know, we're no longer diseased because obviously a lot of us aren't. so they have to take another stance now that we have. It's a political view, I guess.
Yes, we're going to be mental illness deniers. Thomas Szasz was the first big mental illness denier. Szasz wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness. And he's a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. And he wrote this book in 1962. And they tried to get him fired from his professorship, even though he had tenure in upstate New York. And what he was basically saying was the problems that people struggle with emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually, they're not served by calling them illnesses. It's a bad name to give them. Illnesses should be reserved for physical diseases. And, of course, there's no evidence for any so-called mental illness, including bipolar, schizophrenia, and so on, that it's biological or even genetic. And if it ever was found to be biologic, it would become a neurological disease like MS or Parkinsonism. And I, after all these decades, I don't believe that it's ever going to be found.
No, they'll never be able to. Yeah, and people are now, they're now with the, all the school shootings. I just was just flipping through TED Talks, and I found one I didn't want to let, it just something about, oh, it wasn't a TED Talk. Actually, no, it was before I was started watching those. I'm just kind of like preparing for a job interview right now. But anyway, I found an article about a guy who did some research. He was like bound and determined to find the gene for violent behavior. Come on. Guess what?
No,
he killed himself.
That's been a racist thing. My wife and I stopped a huge racist federal program that was back in the 90s. We write about it in the book called The War Against Children of Color. We actually stopped this huge racist program. It was going to find the genetic causes for why little black children in the inner city were growing up to be violent. What an atrocity against children, against African Americans. But we actually stopped the whole program. I'm getting near the end. Is there time for me to go to Todd, or should we tell Todd to call back next time I'm on the air, next Wednesday at 4 p.m. New York time? Todd, are you there? I think, folks, we are going into the end of the show. Call back again, Todd. This is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. I've had a great show. Enjoyed talking to all of you. Thank you so, so much. And the listeners I didn't get to, you will call me back again. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.